Thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you very much to AmCham for giving me the opportunity to speak in my hometown of Adelaide. So today I'm going to discuss the bank's assessment of the current economic situation, both in the world and in the Australian economy. I'll also talk about some of the key uncertainties about the future economic path. In particular, I'll highlight the tension between labour market data and output data, not only here in Australia, but also in a number of economies around the world. And how that tension resolves in the period ahead will be an important determinant of the future path of monetary policy. But I'm going to start with the global economy, and it's important to remember that the Australian economy and financial conditions are significantly influenced by global developments. The global economy recorded a strong pace of growth through 2017 and the first half of 2018. But it lost momentum in the second half of 2018, and that loss of momentum has continued into this year. GDP growth slowed in China and in Europe in the second half of 2018, although in the US it continued at a more than respectable pace. So we don't yet have GDP readings for 2019, but the loss of momentum is evident in business surveys of manufacturing conditions in many economies. The slowdown, though, is not as marked in surveys of business conditions in the services sector. And this potentially indicates that the drivers of the slowdown are much more external rather than internal. Services say more about domestic demand, demand you're generating yourself, which is generally more resilient. It is also worth remembering that we have both more and more frequent indicators of manufacturing than we do of the services sector. So the stuff which gets reported in the media, like, including by my friend Mr. Heath over here, who's another economics graduate from Adelaide Uni, from Bloomberg, that the high-frequency data is very much on the manufacturing sector rather than on the services sector, and that often drives the news cycle. Yet in many economies, including in Australia, the services sector accounts for well over half of the economy, education obviously being one decently large chunk of the services sector. So at the same time as GDP growth has slowed, the labour market in a number of economies has remained strong, and that's what I'm going to show you. I can master the clicker. There we go. So what I'm showing you here is quarterly growth. The red bars are quarterly growth in GDP in four economies, US, Canada, Germany, and the UK. And the blue bars are growth in employment. So if you look at the far right-hand end of each country, and in particular Germany, Canada, and the UK, you can see that employment was actually pretty good. But output wasn't. And that was particularly true in Germany and particularly true in Canada. And so you can see, so for Canada, the UK and Germany, the blue bar is a hell of a lot bigger than the red bar. So a lot of jobs, but apparently those people weren't doing anything. So in the US, though, there was GDP growth was around 2% in the final quarter. Employment growth was almost as strong. So a critical question for us as monetary policymakers is which of these is providing the best signal of the global growth impulse? Is it GDP or is it the labour market? How can we reconcile the difference? So one explanation is that productivity growth is weak, but by and large, that's just a tautology. So productivity growth is the rate of growth in output less the rate of growth in employment. So saying that productivity growth is low or negative is just an accounting outcome of strong employment and weak output growth. So it's not really an explanation. Another more plausible explanation is that the labour market is a lagging indicator. That is, output's slow, but it takes a while for that to be reflected in employment. And so the strength of the labour market at the end of 2018 is simply a reflection of the strength in output in the first half of 2018. So if you look at the red bars in the first part of 2018, they're bigger than they are in the second part. So that may be true, but the strength in the labour market has actually continued into this year. And so this begs the question of why are businesses still continuing to hire people in the face of a slowdown in growth that started in the middle of last year? So I'll come back to that issue in the Australian context later. The continued strong growth in employment has seen unemployment rates in the US, Germany, Japan, and even the UK decline to multi-decade lows. So the unemployment rates in all those countries are basically the lowest they've been since the early 1970s. As a result, wages growth is picking up in all of those economies, but the pickup in wages has taken longer and been more gradual than expected, although it is happening now. So wages growth is currently running above 3% in the US, the UK and in Germany. And in each case, that's the highest pace of wages growth in around a decade. In Japan, wages growth is in positive territory, which is good for them, because most of the time over the past 20 years, people have been having wage declines. But this pickup in wages growth has yet to translate into any noticeable rise in inflation. So we had a sharp fall in oil prices at the end of last year, and that's dampened inflation, although that's mostly reversed now. So this disinflationary impulse has run its course for the time being. So coming back to the key question, what has caused the global economy to slow? So one explanation is China. So the Chinese economy has slowed. Some of the slowing was expected as labour force growth in China slows with the population dynamics there. And furthermore, they've had very strong rates of productivity growth for quite a long time, but that wasn't never going to be sustained as they as the transformation of the economy that has continually occurred over the past couple of decades. So the slowing because of those two things has been expected for quite some time and hasn't been a surprise. But the recent slowdown has been more than expected, and in particular, more than the Chinese policymakers appear to have expected. So a significant contributor to the slowdown has been the clampdown on shadow or non-bank finance in China. So that was done deliberately to address the financial stability concerns they had arising from the high and rapidly growing stock of debt in China. The clampdown on non-bank finance particularly affected the private sector in China, which has been an important engine of growth for the last while. Chinese policymakers have responded to the slowdown by providing some stimulus in recent months, but this has been done in a measured way. There has been increased fiscal stimulus, including through increased infrastructure spending, but they're trying to balance the objective of restraining debt growth against the need to support activity and employment. Hence, the stimulus is not of the scale that was implemented at various times over the past decade, most obviously in 2008-2009, when there was an extremely large fiscal stimulus in China, which benefited both them and us as well. They have also aimed to alleviate the monetary restraint, but there is a question of how effective or timely this stimulus might be, given that credit is being provided now primarily through the core state-owned banking system rather than the non-bank financial system. So the state-owned banks have not traditionally been that focused on lending to the private sector. So there's not any written version of the talk, but to put it crudely, so the state-owned bank, first of all, has to find the private sector, which they haven't traditionally done in China. Then they have to work out how to lend to the private sector because credit hasn't necessarily been top of mind in their earlier lending decisions to their local state-owned enterprise. So they have to find the private sector and then do credit and then actually start making the loans. So they're having to learn how to do credit assessment, and all that means that the effect of the monetary stimulus, the change in direction over the course of this year, may take a little while to become apparent. So they've changed direction, but it's probably going to take a little while before we'll see its full effect. The effect of the various elements of policy stimulus in China will have effects on different parts of the global economy. So what I've got here is four indicators of what's going on in China at the moment. So you can see on the top left, industrial production, which was really, so you can see the effect of the fiscal stimulus in 2009. So the big drop, which is late 08, early 09, is the immediate effect of the financial crisis, massive drop in industrial production, huge swing back up, which is massive fiscal stimulus, and then it's gradually slowed over the course of the subsequent decade. The manufacturing PMI is a survey of how things are going in China at the moment by talking to a bunch of businesses in China. And you can see the slowdown there towards the end of the series as it dips below 50, which is roughly normal growth in China. So you can see it dipping below 50 at the end of 2018, which is the slowdown as this credit crackdown took effect, and then it's bounced back in the first part of this year. Fixed asset investment, which is roughly infrastructure investment, was very strong for much of the past decade, slowed again at the end of 2018 and started to turn around this year. And then retail sales in China, which have been growing at a decent pace and then also slowed dramatically at the end of 2018. So a crude so the stimulus is going to start to affect all of these things probably in the next month or two. And a crude characterisation is that the Australian economy will benefit from the infrastructure spending, Germany is going to benefit from the investment spending and industrial production, and Italy from consumer discretionary spending. And those different indicators provide one lens through which to view the impact of the policy stimulus across those different sectors of the Chinese economy over the coming months. And a final point on the Chinese economy is that even more than in other countries, it is very hard to get a read on household spending on services in China. Yet that is accounting for an increasingly large share of the Chinese economy. So when people look at China and they try and get a sense of what's going on the consumer side, they look at that indicator on the bottom right, retail sales. The retail sales in China account for less than one third of overall consumer spending. Like us, they do a lot of their spending on services, and there is almost no indicator on that in China. So, as I said, focusing on retail sales potentially gives a bit of a misleading lens as to what's actually going on. Another factor that has contributed to the decline in global growth is the escalation in trade tensions over the past year or so. The effect has been more from the uncertainty about where the trade disputes might land rather than the tariffs that have been implemented to date. So my sense is that while they prefer not to have the tariffs there at all, if they knew what they were and that they were unlikely to change, then they could plan around them. But the ongoing uncertainty about when China and the US are likely to reach a deal, what form that deal might take, and how durable that deal might be, makes it difficult to make investment decisions on new productive capacity. And this is particularly the case for investment decisions for businesses in the global supply chain. So do various parts of the global supply chain need to locate? So if America's going to impose a tariff on China, do I need to shift my production from one out of China and into Vietnam or Bangladesh, say? Or do I need to shift my part of my production out of Mexico into somewhere else or not? So do I need to locate, and if so, where? And if I don't know the answer to that question, I'm not going to do anything until I do. That investment uncertainty has played out in many economies, particularly in the manufacturing sector, and the slowdown in investment spending globally has affected economies right along the supply chain, and Germany being a prime example of that. Let me talk briefly about some global financial developments. So, as you probably are aware, there was a marked decline in many asset prices at the end of 2018, a pretty decent decline in some stock prices. Part of that decline reflected a welcome correction from stretched asset valuations late last year. But the speed of the decline, overlaid with growing unease about that slowdown in the global economy I was just talking about, very much heightened people's concerns. Subsequently, many, in fact most, of these asset price movements have been reversed. Global equity prices had one of their best quarters in the first quarter of this year. So best quarters ever in the first quarter of this year. Credit spreads, so the spread of corporate borrowers above government borrowing rates, which had widened towards the end of last year, have tightened right back up to their previous historically low levels. And as a result, at the moment, global financial conditions are very accommodative. There's also been, as this graph is going to show, a marked shift in expectations about the future path of monetary policy. So what I've got here, so the solid line is the policy rate in these six economies, US, Australia, Canada, the UK, New Zealand, and the euro area. So the solid line is the policy rate. So you can see ours there at 1.5%. The dotted lines are market expectations about the future path of policy rates. So you can see for the US, on the 1st of November last year, the expectation was that the Fed would raise rates a few more times over the course of this year. Today's expectations is the red line, and so as you can see there, in the US, the expectation now is that rather than raising rates, there's some chance the Fed's actually going to be lowering rates over the course of this year. So this shift in policy expectations, and you can see it's that shift has been reflected in all of these countries, where in a number of cases, including here, there being some expectation that the next move in rates is going to be up. Now the assessment is by and large the next move in rates is going to be down, except in Europe where they've got them down so low that they probably can't go any lower. So this shift in policy expectations combined with increased pessimism about the global economic outlook has seen government bond yields decline significantly. So in Australia, the 10-year government bond yield reached an all-time low of just under 1.75% last month. So as a result of that decline in bond yields, let's shift on. So this is the yield curve. So you might have read a bit recently about the US yield curve becoming inverted. So what that is the difference between the 10-year government bond yield in the US and the US policy rate. So when it's negative, it means the policy rate is higher than the 10-year yield. And as you can see on the graph there, when this has happened in the past, mostly, although not always, it's been followed by a recession in the US, and that's got people excited at the moment. So, as I said, it's often been a leading indicator of recession in the US. So in thinking about this issue, there are a few considerations that are worth bearing in mind. Firstly, term premia in sovereign bond markets are unusually low. So what do I mean by that? So when I hold a 10-year government bond, I've got to hold it for 10 years, and a few things can happen in the course of 10 years, and I probably want to get a bit of compensation for how long I'm going to hold on to that bond. Whereas if I'm holding on to something for 90 days, not too much can happen in 90 days. And so I don't require so much compensation. So term premia in sovereign bonds are unusually low. In fact, in the US, most estimates have them as negative. So actually, I'm not getting any compensation. I'm actually paying to hold long-term government bonds in the US. Historically, this premium in the US has averaged around 150 basis points. So if you added 150 basis points to that final observation, so we stuck a normal term premium back in there, then that number is quite a long way away from zero. It's actually 150, and we wouldn't be having this discussion about recessions. Secondly, in the past, the yield curve has inverted when the policy rate, which I showed you a second ago, has risen into clearly restrictive territory. That's happened in each of those previous episodes, and that isn't obviously happened this time around. Thirdly, as I said just a minute ago, credit spreads, so corporate borrowing spreads, are tightening. That also doesn't normally happen as the economy slows. So if I'm lending to a corporate and the economy's slowing, my probability of default's going up, and so I want to be compensated for that. Credit spreads are going to be widening, they are not going to be tightening into a recession. So on the back of there are just a few things to think about as to whether or not you should get panicked about the fact that the yield curve in the US is inverted. By turning now to the Australian economy, I'll get there. So what I'm showing you here is GDP growth and employment growth in Australia. So GDP growth in the second half of the year came in weaker than we'd expected. Some of the weakness was temporary, such as the disruption to resource exports and the effect of the drought. But the primary reason for the slowdown has been that consumption growth has been markedly slower in the second half of the year than we had forecast. Partly that was because the earlier rate of consumption growth was revised lower than had been earlier reported. So we had thought that had been told that the consumption had been growing at 3%, and then the statistician found out some new information. It turns out it was only growing at 2 and a bit percent. So there was a bit of a difference there. But beyond that, the growth in the consumption in the second half of the year was considerably slower than we had anticipated. So why did consumption growth slow so markedly in the second half of the year? Some part of the slowdown is likely to be related to the decline in house prices, primarily in Sydney and Melbourne. I'm not so sure that it's from the direct wealth effect of lower housing prices as much as it is from the fact that turnover in the housing markets in Sydney and Melbourne is at very low levels, and which is typically the case when housing prices have been falling. So as people are moving house less because there's much less turnover, they are spending less on things like household furnishings. And they're also spending less on cars. So it's not the fact that house prices per se are lower, driving the lower consumption. I think it's more likely the fact that people are just moving house less, which is doing it. One puzzle related to the possible wealth effect is that the slowdown in household spending has been much more pronounced in New South Wales than it's been in Victoria, despite similar declines in house prices in the two states. Some part of that is down to population growth, which is much stronger in Victoria than New South Wales, but it doesn't account for the whole difference. But the main explanation, I think, as to why consumption growth has slowed has been the low growth in household income and an increasing expectation that it's going to stay low. And the governor has made this point in recent commentary. But while consumption has been unexpectedly weak, other parts of GDP have evolved broadly as we had expected. So that was the negative part, this is the more positive part. So business investment outside the mining sector. So this is not investment in the mining sector, this is investment in the rest of the economy, has been growing at a good rate. Some part of this is related to the infrastructure spending occurring right around the country, but far from all of it. In fact, a decent chunk of the blue line, the buildings and engineering, is actually accounted for by the education sector, which is doing a decently large amount of spending of late, and a decent chunk of it is actually accounted for by the health sector. And in fact, the building just down the road was in those numbers a year or so ago. So there's been pretty strong growth in infrastructure spending occurring right round the country. There's also been strong growth in investment in machinery and equipment and in computer software, which is the line at the bottom. Mining investment has continued its large decline from its peak 5 years ago, but that decline is pretty much at its end today. In fact, we expect mining investment is going to increase fairly soon. In fact, most of the large resource companies have announced, including Fortescue last week, have announced pretty large investment plans for the next few years. So that we had this big run-up in mining investment up until about 5 years ago, very big rundown over the past 5 years. Now we've pretty much hit bottom and it's actually going to start increasing again. We're not about to have the same a repeat of what we had 5 or 6 years ago, but the growth is going to be positive nonetheless, and it's not going to be a drag on the economy, on economic growth, like it has been over the past 5 years. Exports have continued to grow as expected. So this is the volume of exports in resources. Just pay, bear in mind that these are on different scales. So resources are on a scale by them, much larger than the rest. But you can see there that the little dip at the end is the effect of a few storms and the like and in resources. But by and large, have been on a pretty strong upward trend for the last number of years. Services, which is primarily education and tourism, but a decently large chunk of that is education. You can see the large growth there. Rural, you can see the impact of the drought there at the end in terms of the decline. And you can also see, perhaps slightly surprisingly, fairly strong growth in manufactured exports over the last few years. So some of that is high-tech manufacturing, which has actually been pretty strong growth. And some of that is related to a lot of stuff which actually happens here, well, here in South Australia, which is wine and food. And a significant part of that actually comes from South Australia. So as you said, we've had pretty widespread growth in all of those areas of exports, with the exception of rural, which is almost completely a story of the drought. So the drought subtracted around 0.25% from aggregate growth in the economy in the second half of last year. So export growth has actually been pretty decent over the last few years and pretty much come in as we'd expected. If I now, so I'm going to get to housing in a minute. So I'll put it up there because everyone likes to look at graphs of housing prices. So you can just look at that one for a bit. So residential construction is at a historically high level, and it's probably going to remain there for most of the rest of the year. But the recent flow of building approvals data that we get implies a much lower level of activity once the current pipeline of activity is completed. So let me talk a little bit about the housing market. I expect we'll probably get a few more questions on it at the end. The supply-demand dynamics are playing out in the housing market at the moment. So we had a very large increase in demand, particularly in Melbourne and Sydney, for housing. It took a while to get the supply. Supply is happening now. And as one thing you do learn in economics, when you know supply is growing faster than demand, or demand's growing faster than supply, prices go up. Supply is growing faster than demand, prices go down. And that's the phase we're in at the moment, is that the supply is increasing quite strongly. And there have been very large falls in house prices in Sydney and Melbourne following the very large increases in the preceding 5 years. There's more supply to come onto the market in Melbourne and Sydney over the remainder of the year, which will further weigh on prices. The one interesting difference between the two cities that may affect their ability to absorb this additional supply is that the vacancy rate in Melbourne is actually very low at the moment, while that in Sydney is above average and rising. So if you look at the rental vacancy rate in Melbourne, it's about as low as it gets at the moment. In Sydney, that's not true. Similarly, advertised rents in Melbourne are increasing while those in Sydney are falling. As you can see in Adelaide, the cycle has been considerably less pronounced than it has been in Melbourne and Sydney. The median house price in Adelaide has increased a little over the past year and has grown at an average pace of around 4% per annum over the past 5 years. And the residential construction cycle has also been considerably more muted in SA than it has been in other states. So we continue to pay close attention to the housing market developments, and in a few weeks' time, we're going to publish our semi-annual financial stability review, which will discuss housing and even, or the housing, the financial stability risks from the housing market in even greater detail. So one of the main indicators about the impact of the unfolding dynamics in the housing market is the mortgage arrears rate. The arrears rate has been edging up nationwide, but actually remains at a low level, and much of the increase in arrears has been in WA. So negative equity, which you might have read about a bit in the paper of late, so that's when the value of your property is less than the value of your mortgage, has also increased, though our estimates are that it is also at a very low level and is again concentrated in WA and mining regions. Negative equity doesn't matter in and of itself. You might not feel that happy about it if you overpaid or you paid more for your house than it's worth today, and if that's now worth more than your mortgage. What actually matters is whether you can still service your mortgage. If you don't have to sell, you don't have to sell, and negative equity doesn't matter. It might make you unhappy, but it doesn't do much else. So the critical factor in the future evolution of both arrears and negative equity is whether the household with the mortgage has an income and has a job. And the labour market is key here, and I'm going to turn to that now. So at the same time as GDP has been surprisingly weak, the labour market has actually been surprisingly strong. The unemployment rate has declined faster than we had forecast, and employment growth is stronger than we had forecast. So GDP growth was weaker than we'd forecast, labour market's actually been stronger than we'd forecast. So what I'm showing you here is the unemployment rate, which is one which mostly gets reported, as well as the underemployment rate, which takes account of the fact that some people in part-time jobs want to work more hours. You can see by and large, although not completely, the series mostly move in the same direction. You can see there is a gap between the two, which has widened a bit of late. But in the most recent past, both of those two things have actually been coming down. So the solid line just smooths out the month-to-month variation in the two series. The unemployment rate has been declining. It's nationwide, it's just under 5% at the moment. And the decline in the unemployment rate has been most evident in New South Wales and Victoria, where in both states it's around multi-decade lows. I mentioned earlier the unemployment rate in the US, Germany and the UK is at multi-decade lows. Same's true in New South Wales and Victoria. It's basically back to the levels of the early 70s in both those two states. The unemployment rate in South Australia is higher than it is in New South Wales and Victoria, but lower than it is in some of the other states. So having left South Australia when South Australia's unemployment rate was the highest in the country, it's pleasing to see now that we're no longer... haven't been for a while, actually, in that place. And in fact, a couple of months ago, South Australia had the third lowest unemployment rate in the country, although admittedly quite a bit higher than New South Wales and Victoria. But overall, the strength of the labour market is at odds with this slow pace of GDP growth. So we've got almost no growth in GDP in the second half of the year, but strong growth in employment growth and an unemployment rate which has continued to come down. So maybe the labour market, as I said earlier, could be a lagging indicator. But at the same time, as I showed a minute ago, businesses continued to invest through the end of 2018 and have continued to hire into 2019. So we have labour market data now up till February. The unemployment rates continue to come down. Employment's continued to grow. So it's a bit of a puzzle as to why businesses are both hiring people and investing in new machinery and equipment and buildings, why they're doing that if growth in economic activity has slowed so much. Moreover, while employment has continued to grow strongly, forward-looking indicators of labour demand suggest that future employment growth will also remain solid. So I'll show you some of these here now. So it's some of them, one of the series which gets a lot of attention is the job ad series from ANZ. Another, and the Department of Jobs and Small Business counts up job ads as well. That's by looking at what businesses are advertising. The ABS series actually goes out and asks businesses, so how many vacancies have you actually got? And you can see there's actually a divergence between those two. So businesses are actually saying that they've got a very high and increasing and still growing level of vacancies at the moment. So that gives you some idea about where employment might go over the period ahead and suggests that employment growth in the period ahead is actually going to remain solid. So the two lenders on economic growth provided by the labour market and the GDP data are in stark contrast. A third lens in the form of business surveys sits somewhere in between the two. So this is a survey of business conditions done by National Australia Bank, which has been going on for a long period of time. And you can see that, so basically it's a net balance which says how many businesses think things are getting better versus how many think things are getting slower. So when it's in positive territory, that's a good thing. So you can see that it did drop off in the second half of last year, but it still remains in positive territory, which still suggests decent economic growth in the period ahead. And that's also the sense we get from our extensive business liaison program. So we've got Matt Carter, who runs our South Australian business liaison program here. And it's true both South Australia and in South Australia and nationally that while businesses think that things slowed towards the end of last year, they still actually remain pretty decent. So that tension between those three different ways of looking at the economy is of crucial importance. So we've got one labour market saying the economy is pretty strong, business conditions saying it's decent, and the GDP data saying it's actually quite soft. Hopefully, we're going to get some resolution of this tension in the coming months with the incoming flow of data. As the unemployment rate has declined and employment growth has remained strong, wages growth has passed its trough, but the pickup is only gradual. So we've only had this very gradual pickup in wages growth. Using disaggregated data, the small and gradual pickup can be explained by a decrease in the prevalence of wage freezes. So the share of workers experiencing wage freezes has declined. As they move off wage freezes, these workers are getting wage increases of a bit above 3%. The rest of the workforce, who have been getting sort of 2 to 3% wage outcomes in recent years, have not generally been receiving higher wage outcomes. So we've seen this pickup in wages growth mostly because less wage freezes, not because everyone who other people are getting higher wage increases. So this low rate, given I'm from the Reserve Bank, I have to show a graph of inflation, so here it is. So this low rate of wages growth has been a major contributor to the rate of inflation remaining a little below the inflation target of 2 to 3% in recent years. So you see we haven't been, most of the time, been a bit below 2% rather than being between 2 and 3. For inflation to rise to be sustainably within the inflation target range of 2 to 3%, we need to see higher wages growth. We'll get a read on the next Consumer Price Index again in a few weeks' time. So let me finish and just summarise the main points. So I've highlighted some of the issues and tension both globally and domestically around the economic outlook. Globally, the effectiveness and extent of the stimulus measures in China that are currently in place in addressing the slowdown in Chinese growth is one of the key uncertainties. Trade developments is another. Domestically, I've highlighted the challenge in determining the current and future pace of the growth in the economy posed by the conflicting signals provided by the labour market, the GDP data, and the business surveys. How those tensions are resolved will play a crucial role in whether we continue to make satisfactory progress in achieving our goals of full employment and the inflation target. So with that, let me stop there and very happy to take questions via Pascal.
So. Thank you, and it's a great pleasure to have the Deputy Governor. I will call him Guy just because I'm contrary and everybody calls him Guy, but it's a French name and it said Guy, so I will call him Guy. Join me if you want. It is actually very interesting to see that presentation of data, not least because, of course, Australia being not such a large country, we see and continue to see great diversity of data from one state to another, which is a conundrum in its own right, because, of course, the Reserve Bank has to sort of deal with one economy as if it were a more homogeneous body, I suppose, that needs to be slowed down or accelerated. It must be somewhat of a frustration to have, for instance, the housing market being so different between Sydney and Melbourne and the other cities, because some of the things that you might want to do could actually affect negatively some areas and help others. How do you deal with that?
So this question gets asked. The frame of the question very depends on which state I'm actually in. So,
from an Adelaide perspective.
That's right. Adelaide's where it's sort of. It's interesting because if you go back, let me get this right, 5 or 6 years ago, everyone was complaining about WA going through the roof and New South Wales going through the floor. Today, exactly the opposite way around. But in the end, we are one economy, and so we have to take, we do look at, as you said, at the we aggregate it up and look at the national level. We're mindful of the fact that the different parts of the economy are growing, growing at different different speeds. But how that translates actually, in the end, we use the aggregate data to assess the aggregate picture. One thing though, which is interesting, so the divergence in unemployment rates between states at the moment is one of the lowest it's been in the country's history. So I mentioned, so in the early 90s, as some of you here may painfully be aware, the unemployment rate in South Australia was probably 7 or 8 percentage points higher than it was in other parts of the country. So today, the difference between the smallest and the lowest unemployment rate and the highest unemployment rate is no more than a couple of percentage points. So yes, parts of the economy are growing at different speeds, but actually the divergence is a little less than it's been in the past. And in the end, there are always different parts of the country growing at different speeds. You know, sometimes the Adelaide Hills are growing faster than the Adelaide Plains. Sometimes it's the opposite. But in the end, we've got one policy tool which we use to address the aggregate outcome. There are other arms of government policy which can be more nuanced in addressing some of those differences across states, and indeed do. But from our point of view, in the end, we're setting policy for the country as a whole. One of the ways, though, that we inform that assessment is not just rely on the official data, but actually make extensive use of our business liaison program in assessing what the different developments are in the different parts of the economy. And that's a very important part of the way we come to our overall assessment of the economy.
Thank you. Now, clearly, that's been a very busy week with the general population being bombarded with information as the two would-be government kind of launched large numbers and projects. I'm sure people here would have questions in relation to either the forecast or the type of investment that are considered without necessarily displaying your political preferences.
Probably avoid commenting on particular circumstances on particular people's policies right at the moment.
But. Indeed, but it's interesting to see that the debate is so firmly grounded in economics and in forecast and in a belief, I suppose, that those levers can actually generate such a transformation of the economy. So I'll open the floor for questions. You've heard Guy say he will not actually provide indication that indicate a political preference. But apart from that, any questions from the floor? Oh, we've got one there.
Stay seated, Guy, if that's okay. Given I work for an American company, I'm an Australian journalist, and I was born and raised in Adelaide. I wanted to ask three questions.
That's greedy.
I want to come back to real nuance here, or basics with the market. In last week's statement, there was obviously quite a reaction to the change in the wording of the last paragraph of the government's statement about setting monetary policy to support sustainable growth as opposed to would be consistent with sustainable growth, which had been the case for many meetings before. Are people reading too much into that? Was there a message behind that? What are they to make of it?
I think one of the things we're trying to highlight is what I was mostly talking about today, which is we've got this, we're just trying to get a handle on where exactly things are and are going in the economy, and that's and how that gets resolved. I mentioned the sort of three different ways of looking at things at the moment, giving you pretty deep. So the divergence between those three at the moment is about as large as it gets, I mean, even though the divergence between the states is about as low as it gets. And really, what we've just got this tension between those, and we just really need to see how that unfolds over the next little while to get a sense of where the economy is at, both at and where it's likely to go. And I suppose that's, you know, mostly what we're trying to highlight at the moment. That's really the sort of first order issue and first order consideration that we need to resolve, basically.
The second one is...
You really are going to
do it. The tax cuts and cash handouts in the budget, are they significant enough to move the dial for household consumption? Is it too early to say? You still think...
It's both too early and... I mean, it's probably just not in my position to say right at the moment.
Okay, fine. You might like this one a bit more. There are signs, it seems, that the housing market's starting to stabilise. Is that how you're reading it? And if so, presumably you've had a good leg down, an orderly leg down in prices. I mean, if it is stabilising now, that's something you'd welcome, and the system has sort of worked to some extent. Is that how you're reading it? And does that make a rate cut less likely?
I'm not going to answer the last part of that, but let me talk. So it's interesting. We haven't pretty much not. I said this last year, and it still remains the case. We're somewhat in uncharted territory in this space, in that most of the time when you have large price falls, it's because the economy's fallen over. That's both true here and around the world. And there haven't, in fact, as best as we can tell, been almost no examples where you've had large decline in house prices in an environment where the economy's actually continued to go along at a decent pace and unemployment has remained low. But so far, that's the way it's played out here. And with any luck, that's where it will continue to play out here. And we don't, I mean, that's the way we actually expect it to continue to play out. So what Michael's referring to is that we got some data this week that approvals for new mortgages actually ticked up in February after having come down a long way. Is that a sign that the housing market has maybe stabilised in New South Wales and Victoria? Not sure, but I mean, a few more months of that and probably be a little more confident in answering that question. So far things have unwound in those two states in particular in a reasonably orderly way. Whether that remains so remains to be seen. And as I said earlier, it's really one of the things we're paying a lot of attention to. But and as I said, partly because we don't have a lot of precedent to guide us here, because we haven't had seen this sort of situation unfold of large house price declines in two states in an environment where the economy in those two states is actually pretty strong.
Thank you, Guy. Do we have any other questions?
One down the front.
Yes? Microphone?
Thanks for that presentation, Guy. It's Mike from Funds Assay. I've got a question more around policy. And globally, interest rates now are very, very low, been low for a very long time. And just the other day in the Fin Review, there was talk about modern monetary theory. At the Reserve Bank, are you guys worried about whether you've got enough policy flexibility to deal with the downturn, were it to come? And this notion of working more closely with fiscal policy and potentially, you know, printing a lot of money and so forth, is that something that's been used in the past? Is that a policy lever that you guys might think at some point in the future where you had a negative downturn?
So it's an interesting question. It's a question I hope I don't have to actually answer in practice, in the sense and also it's not our expectation we're actually going to get to that point at the moment. That is our expectation. So we do think we have, our policy rate is 1.5%. We think we can lower that. Well, we can lower that. definitely can do that. We've looked at, and I said this again at the end of last year, we have looked at what other countries have done in terms of dealing with addressing the issue of providing more stimulus when you're sort of roughly at the lowered interest rates as much as you can. So we had a look at that and got some sense of how that might go. So we've thought about that, but with any luck, that will stay as a thought, and we won't actually have to answer that question in practice. The expectation is at the moment is our expectation is that we will see decent growth in the economy, a further decline in unemployment, and so we won't have to get to that point. But if we end up in that point, unfortunately, then we have given some thought as to how that might go.
Any other questions? Yes, over there.
Thanks very much for your presentation, Guy. I'm just interested with the low interest rate environment, forward-looking expectations for returns are lowered. And I'd just be interested in the Reserve Bank's thinking around people that are investing versus people that have debt, and how that dilemma plays out, because I guess what we're seeing is if expectations for returns are lower, people are looking at taking on more growth assets to assist them in getting the return that they're looking for. At the same time, that introduces more risk into their portfolio, so they have more fluctuations in returns. And yeah, I'm just interested in the Reserve Bank's perspective on that.
So we're well aware that that's part of the transmission, that there are, and we've done a decent amount of work to look at. So I'll come to your precise question in a minute, but another question we often get asked, and the government gets plenty of correspondence on this one, is that when we lower rates, that benefits people with debt, but people who are self-funded retirees living on their bank deposits, their rate of return goes down. So you get plenty of correspondence on that one. That's true. Monetary policy has always had that, always has that effect. It's maybe more stark now than it might have been in the past. And in the end, the economic analysis that we have says that, yes, that's true, but the increased spending from the debtors outweighs the decreased spending from the creditors in aggregate, which is what we care about. I can understand if you're one or other of those, you may have different personal opinions as to whether that's a good or a bad thing. But anyway, that is part of the overall aggregate transmission. Your point about overall investment is right in that as rates have come down, you know, part of the transmission again is that people shift into, into more equity or the like, and that can be more volatile. I think it turns out that over the past 12 months, the best asset you could have been in actually is fixed income, notwithstanding how low rates are, because they've gone down even lower. But nevertheless, it has that again is part of the transmission, as it pushes people a bit further out along the risk spectrum. It's something we take into account. Our financial stability area spends a fair bit of time thinking and worrying about that. That's always been part of the transmission of monetary policy, and it potentially, as I said, a bit more stark now with rates at such low levels. The other thing, though, I think, which people do tend to forget a bit, is that people generally think in nominal terms rather than in real terms. So, yep, nominal rates are low, but so is inflation. And so real rates of return haven't fallen necessarily as much as nominal rates of return. And people, I think, have in the back of their mind that inflation is quite a bit higher than it is at the moment, or their experience is based on a period where inflation was quite a bit higher, and haven't quite recalibrated for the fact that, why are rates low? It's because inflation's low, which means real rates of return are actually haven't come down as much as nominal rates of return.
Thank you. I'm very conscious of time, so we'll allow for one more question. If there was one there to the left, that'll be the final question.
Thank you. Simon Evans, I'm with the Financial Review. Guy, just wanted to ask, a couple of weeks ago, David Murray, who's a fair banking doyen, raised the point at a seminar in Sydney that he was worried that there was a bit of a build-up of systemic risk because perhaps there was too much illiquid assets that had built up in industry super funds. Do you have a view on that?
I think I'm going to get into particular super funds investment portfolios. One thing, and I don't think it matters too much looking at which super fund we have looked at. One thing we have looked about which has been noticeable more generally, is liquidity in many markets. It seems to be less than it has been in the past or historically. Part of that is expected as a result of changes in financial regulations post-crisis. So if you look at a bunch of asset prices these days, be it illiquid investments or other things, there's been some fairly large swings. If you actually look at actual volatility, most asset classes at the moment, volatility is actually at incredibly low levels. But then we have these periods, so we have this these periods where volatility is low, and then there are these big spikes every once in a while. And that's true right across the board in terms of a whole bunch of asset classes, be it equity prices. So if you think about what happened last December, some very large declines in equity prices in a very short period of time. It's been true in fixed income markets, it's been true in foreign exchange. So most of the time these days, volatility is very low, and then it's not for a short period of time with these big bursts and these large asset price movements. And so the market dynamics out there have changed quite a bit from the way they were for quite a long period of time. And some of that, as I said, is by design, and some of it, again, us and people like us around the world are trying to get a better sense of. So that's another thing to think about in terms of your overall investment is the liquidity in the markets that you're actually investing in. And that has actually changed, or does appear to have changed, in reasonably material ways. Most of the time, it's something you don't have to worry about. In fact, liquidity in sort of normal times, for want of a better term, is arguably as good as it's ever been. But then we hit these liquidity air pockets, that's probably a reasonable way of describing it, and then you get some pretty decent price movements in a short period of time. Let me finish on one thing, though, which I think is interesting to keep perspective on. So while that's sort of generally true, if you go, and a lot of this is blamed on machines, and the fact that there are much more machines who trade in markets than people these days. But I'll just finish with an anecdote about how it used to be in the trading markets. So before there were a lot of machines, there were much more people. You also used to hit liquidity air pockets, which wasn't because the traders were going out for lunch, although it may have contributed. But when there were large price movements back in the day, and particularly in foreign exchange markets is the best example of this, you used to see liquidity dry up. And the way that used to happen back then was the traders just didn't answer the phone. And so they wouldn't give you a price. So you'd ring up for a price and they wouldn't answer the phone. That was a liquidity pocket back in the day. Today, it's the machines turn themselves off and pull out of the market. So it's a different manifestation, and it's a lot faster than it used to be. But back in the day, it used to be so much better in terms of liquidity. It's like, yeah, but you used to hit these liquidity pockets back then. They just took a slightly different form. So machines have taken over in the trading space like they have in some other spaces. And so the way it manifests itself is the same. Is different, but there are some decent similarities as well.